Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the U.S. government upended by COVID. The president is back in the White House claiming he feels better than he has in 20 years. But messaging from his doctors has sown doubts about that upbeat assessment. Meanwhile, the number of infections associated with the outbreak continues to climb and threatens to disrupt not only the presidential campaign, but also the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Ed Luce is national editor and columnist at the Financial Times and author of the book The Retreat of Western Liberalism. I spoke with him Tuesday morning about the chaos engulfing Washington. Ed, the past few days regarding both the health and behavior of President Donald Trump have been head-spinning. What's been your reaction?
It's so hard to compress my reaction into a calm, detached, you know, appraisal of the president's behavior. I think, you know, it's first and foremost a reminder that the whole world is about him. The drama is always about him. And that's always been the case, of course. But this is an extraordinary sort of elevation or escalation, rather, of that sort of Trumpian solipsism. Everything is about him. So I think that, you know, the idea that you can, through an act of will, defeat this coronavirus brings up a couple of points. One is the very obvious one, that when you have a team of 14 doctors, the chief medical officer, Dr. Sean Conley, led by him, who is working for you rather than with you, then that's a slightly different example of how most people experience any kind of disease, including COVID. They don't hire or fire their doctor. Second is, he, you know, announced he was bored in hospital. He's mid-treatment. He's very early into this disease. There's another week or 10 days to assess, you know, the danger to him and whether this cocktail of medications is going to work. And I think all of us have seen the timeline for Herman Cain, who contracted the disease in late June and died late July, more than 30 days later, having declared himself feeling well, healthy, out of hospital. And so the idea that Trump can sort of overrule medical advice and say, I'm better, my will, my optimism has defeated this fear that is gripping you out there in the media and elsewhere about this disease, it's not so bad, is the height of solipsism. And of course, it's also reckless. And then, you know, finally, the cocktail of drugs that he's been given, this antiretroviral, remdesivir, the steroids he's been on, the vitamins he's been receiving, the antacid, the experimental immunity-boosting drug that the FDA sort of fast-tracked him. This is a unique clinical trial. Nobody else has taken this cocktail of drugs. So we don't know how well they're going to work. Neither does Donald Trump, but we can be completely sure that it is not available to pretty much anyone else in America unless they're a billionaire. So there is no example here that Trump should be using to project to the rest of the American people. And I guess that's what's most shocking. It's all about him. He cannot extend his empathy to, or imagination, to the situation a typical American would be in.
To the more than 200,000 people who died, to their families, to the public at large, he has said, don't worry, don't think so much about the COVID. Don't worry so much about it. What did you make of that?
It's coming at a point where, you know, America has never flattened the curve. And I think, you know, the bulk of the blame, or a huge share of the blame, has to go to America's leader for America's failure to flatten the curve. But it comes at a point where the failure to flatten the first wave is running into the beginning of the second wave. And so we're still at, you know, a baseline of 40,000 new infections a day, roughly 700 deaths a day. More than 2,000 people died whilst Donald Trump was at Walter Reed. And thousands more will die in the coming weeks. Now is the second chance for a commander-in-chief who's failed to really lead or take seriously a pandemic to say, right, we're going into the influenza season, we're going into winter, we're going into situations where we're going to be indoors and in poorly ventilated areas more frequently than we were in the summer. Now is a chance to reset. And I, having contracted this disease, have a better understanding of what we can do about it. That's what he could have said. He could have used his own personal condition as a way to say, we've got to redouble our efforts. Instead, he's doubling down on the dismissiveness of this disease. He's presenting it in almost a sort of, I hate to use the word fascistic, but this will, triumph of the will, this will to power, that if only you have positive thinking, what Mary Trump, his niece, calls toxic positivity, then we can override this disease. You don't need to worry about masks. You don't need to worry about any of the precautions these boffins in the scientific community are advising, and that Joe Biden is following. You can just defeat it by being strong and macho and dominant, like me. And I don't know what to say about that. It's a level of recklessness and irresponsibility that I find incredibly hard to forgive. It's endangering people. It's endangering hundreds of thousands of people.
You know, he was given steroids. And some have reported that those steroids make you feel, as he said, I feel 20 years younger. I've heard other people say that being on steroids can give you that same kind of elevated sense of power. He walked up those stairs at the White House, and you could see he was winded by the time he got up there and was breathing very heavily. How long can he be on those steroids? Do you know?
This particular one, dexamethasone, again, you know, it's never been tried before in combination with this immunity-boosting drug that's been fast-tracked for him, and remdesivir. So there is an experimental sort of quality, you know, what they call VIP treatment here, that the kitchen sink has been thrown. So we don't know what the outcome is here. We do know that it's early to proclaim anything. And we know that Dr. Connolly, you know, is sadly a real spin doctor. I mean, this is spin doctoring, refuses to give basic information about when the tests were taken, when he believes that the president contracted the disease, refuses to call in the CDC to do contact tracing amongst the hundreds of people who have been exposed to the president, both at the White House and in Bedminster in New Jersey at his golf club at that fundraiser last week that he attended. So I think that the exhilaration, the sort of risk-takingness of Donald Trump was present before he took the steroids. I think he's always been like that. So this might be sort of what economists are called a pro-cyclical drug, in that he already exhibited those patterns of behavior. But what you want is the counter-cyclical drug in those situations. You want some reality in his head.
So given what you've just said about Dr. Conley and the presentation there at Walter Reed, what is the American people to believe? Are all the doctors in cahoots, as it were, not telling the American people what the truth is?
I think you have to believe, I think you have to be extremely skeptical towards his medical team. Remember, Dr. Conley, back in May, was the one who signed off and issued a public statement about Trump taking the hydroxychloroquine, which shows no evidence of preventive stopping you from getting the disease. I know very, very little and highly contested studies as to what it does if you do get the disease. So Dr. Conley, I think, is already like one of his predecessors for Donald Trump, is already compromised his independent medical standing before this happened. But the briefings he gave outside Walter Reed and the admission by him that essentially he was speaking to an audience of one in his hospital room, namely President Trump, watching him, I think should give us the utmost skepticism about any public pronouncements on the president's health.
I wonder if it also gives us a sense, or gives you or me, a sense of sympathy for that doctor being put into that position. Is his oath of care to honest medical statement, or is his oath to carry out that which his patient, the President of the United States, demands of him?
It's a very good question, because it's clear that they're directly clashing, these two oaths. This is the commander-in-chief, and he is a military man as well as a medical man. He's from the Navy. But he's also taken the Hippocratic Oath. Maybe this is forcing him to take the hypocritical oath. I don't know. It's hard to know how you would reconcile those two obligations. You know, when you have a president who's insisting on directing the PR messaging of whatever he says. So I don't know. I do feel sorry for him. I think it's really tough. I think, you know, whoever the president is the president. And it would take an enormous act of sort of bravery to contradict what he is directly, personally asking you to do. You remember in 2016, the then candidate, Trump's nominee, Trump's doctor, issued a statement which he later disclosed had been dictated to him by Trump, in which he said Trump would be the healthiest president ever to take office in American history. So, you know, it's not just this doctor. There was also Jackson, one of his predecessors. It's not just this doctor. And of course, look at Dr. Deborah Birx and the expression on her face when the president earlier this year at one of those coronavirus task force briefings said things like disinfectant could be ingested and that might help defeat the virus. I mean, she was obviously dying 1,000 deaths inside, but she couldn't bring herself in public to contradict him.
Whereas Anthony Fauci has indeed contradicted him on several occasions and has felt the wrath of the White House after doing so.
Yes, and you know, Fauci, I think, has been exemplary, and he's been a real public servant throughout this pandemic. I think to some degree we should give plaudits to Dr. Robert Redfield at the CDC, whose agency has been really, really subjected to extraordinary pressures by the White House and Department for Health and Human Services, and has managed, I think, broadly to hold the line. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of federal scientists who are feeling, I think, what it must have felt like to work a little bit, like it must have felt to work in a true autocracy, where you know that speaking science can cost you, well, it would cost you your life in Stalin's Russia, but it would cost you your job in Trump's Washington. And so the chilling effect on federal scientists is an untold story. I've sort of caught glimpses of it and shreds of it here and there, but I think it's an untold story of just how extreme that pressure is. And I think the patron saint of every scientist in government is Dr. Fauci right now.
And a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Ed Luce. Here is the rest of my conversation with Ed Luce, U.S. national editor and columnist at the Financial Times. Give me, if you will, a contrast with how Boris Johnson was treated when he came down with the virus and the reporting on his condition then and the reporting on his condition now, which I gather has left him with some after effects.
Yeah, that's something that might even be observable when you see him doing his public events from Downing Street. But when he was admitted to hospital, which I think was late March, it might have been early April, he had been in the previous week isolated on the upper floor of the private apartment within 10 Downing Street where the Prime Minister lives. And he'd been not interacting with Downing Street staff, but he'd been releasing these rather badly recorded videos on Twitter saying he was doing really well, he was getting better, he was improving, just a matter of time. And then suddenly he was admitted to hospital after about a week of this. And as you know, put on a ventilator, which is a sign that you're halfway towards death, statistically speaking. So he came pretty close to dying. And I think, you know, because this was in the early stages of the pandemic, in spite of the fact that Boris Johnson had been taking a very Trumpian position of denialism about how serious it was and had been boasting about going around hospitals and shaking hands with people, and in spite of the fact he had flirted, and the British government therefore had flirted with embracing the herd immunity approach to the pandemic, namely, let's just get everybody infected and get this over with. In spite of all that, his opinion poll ratings really did rocket after his near-death experience, I guess because of the sympathy factor, and also because he was in a National Health Service hospital, and the NHS is something approaching a secular religion in Britain. And he was very thankful for the care he received. But since then, you know, frankly, he hasn't had, in terms of policy or competence, much of a road to Damascus. There's not much evidence that, you know, this has made him take scientific advice more seriously. The government throughout the summer had this program, a subsidy, a £10 per meal subsidy to encourage people to go out and eat in restaurants. When, you know, if the point was to save the restaurants, you should just transfer the money directly to them. Why endanger everybody's health? And then they got rid of that predictably. And people told them before it started, now this is dumb. So that's just one example. There've been dozens of similar examples of stuff that intuitively, immediately, you and I could say, this isn't going to work. They're going to have to climb down about a month from now. And we've had this sort of cockamamie, magical, gimmicky approach. And Britain is now, you know, again, back in the forefront of rising infections in Europe. And very, very little public trust in the government, and Boris's ratings are back down to the very low levels they were at prior to his sickness.
And how is his health now?
This is all rumor based, so I can't answer that definitively. But you know, I know a lot of people, you know, who are quite responsible with what they say and are not sort of working for tabloids, say that, look, there's been a clear sort of decline in his mental acuity, and there's a very evident fatigue. There are signs he might be a long hauler, as they call it, somebody who's got longer term issues related to the disease. Again, though, what I'd say about Boris is it's not like we had this Socratic leader before he got sick and now his quality of governance has deteriorated. He's always been a bit of a showman and never really been a very serious prime minister, even though he won the election hands down. It's quite hard to sort of point to a period pre-COVID where, oh, look, that's when he was firing on all cylinders. That's when he was really consistent and clear and admirable as a leader. That period didn't happen.
Now President Trump is back at the White House. What about the White House staff? And I'm not just talking about those who have their own private offices or those who report directly to him while he's up in the private quarters. What about the staff, like the butlers, like the housekeepers, like the cooks? How can they be protected from a possible contagion from a man who is clearly still within that long period when he could give it to other people?
It's a very sort of poignant question because, you know, if you look at the hundreds of people who work in the White House over the course of a week, people are coming in and out, people are permanent, the cleaners, the cooks, the butlers, the various positions on all levels of the White House, disproportionately likely to be Black and non-white. And so you have in microcosm, really, within the White House, what we've seen nationally, which is the frontline essential workers are disproportionately non-white, are being asked to carry on with their jobs, regardless of whether the people with whom they interface are taking precautions. And, you know, many of us are. I think by now, the majority of America is. So it's probably, you know, less dangerous today to be a bus driver or an Amazon delivery person than it would have been in March. I do think that the customers are more responsible on average. But Trump isn't. Trump hasn't adjusted his behavior. And, you know, as we saw on Monday night, that mask just came straight off. The rules, you know, have apparently now been changed by Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, that you must wear a mask inside the White House. Let's just take pause there. 6 months into this, the White House finally says you've got to wear a mask. It's later than the sort of most rundown McDonald's in the most deprived urban part of America. It's months later than anywhere else. This is the White House. It sets the tone. So I feel desperately sorry for people, you know, who've got to work for a president and many around him who are contemptuous of these guidelines and believe that they're a sign of being effete or politically correct, feminine in a way, because Trump's consciously trying to be masculine, his idea of masculine, with this impatience for guidelines.
Have you been able to speak directly or even indirectly with members of the Republican Party on Capitol Hill as to their reactions and their predictions about moving forward?
To some, not as many as I would otherwise. I mean, as you know, Capitol Hill's not got particularly strict protocols either. So there is a big division because of the contrasting signaling from the president and from Biden. There is a big division between how Republicans and Democrats behave on Capitol Hill. There are some Republicans who do wear masks, notably Mitch McConnell does wear a mask, but there are many who do not. People like Rand Paul, quite astonishingly, even though he himself had COVID and is a doctor, generally doesn't wear a mask. There was an instance about a week ago with a Republican congressman from Texas, and I'm forgetting which one it was, who was on a flight to Austin, and he refused to wear a mask. And so passengers videoed it and released it on Twitter. And he was asked by one of the flight attendants to put a mask on, point blank refused. It's been politicized into a sort of all-important symbol of whether you are a conservative or a liberal. And this is why, when we were discussing earlier the president's role in this pandemic, he bears disproportionate blame for setting the tone. If it were President Jeb Bush, if it were President Marco Rubio, or just pick any one of really the people who were competing with Trump in 2016, I have no doubt that they would have set rules and followed them and behaved, you know, in a sort of vaguely responsible way. And therefore, the entire Republican Party would be following. And that, therefore, the American pandemic story would be different. So, unfortunately, you know, they are taking their cue from the president on Capitol Hill. And as a result, you've got many more Republican legislators infected than Democratic ones.
Trump's campaign seems to regard himself as an example of not only strength, but how he can use this COVID virus to his advantage in the election process. Do you see that happening?
No. To be honest, I think that his sort of plan A was not to talk about the coronavirus at all, was to focus on, we've got to get the economy going again, and we've got to stop our cities being dominated by radical extremists, and we need to stay strong and America first with the world against China. And that, those are the sorts of topics I think his campaign wanted to be discussing, particularly the sort of, you want Black Lives Matter to move into the White House kind of line that he'd been developing in the last 2-3 months. This now, I think, brings it back to COVID, which is an area that he's not comfortable. He doesn't have a good record. He's claimed he's not responsible. And it's an area where Biden's got much higher trust ratings than president. Biden is also no longer in the basement. You know, that was a sort of a consistent line. You're in the basement, you're stuck in the basement in Delaware. Well, Biden's been getting out and about. I'm sure that's one of the reasons Trump checked himself out of Walter Reed quicker than he might otherwise should have. The opinion polls are mostly that show Biden's lead widening, a 14 percentage point lead, the Wall Street Journal. There's another today, Tuesday, for CNN, 16 point lead. I think they're probably going to be inflated, but they're clearly in the wake of last week's debate. The degree to which Trump's pantomime at Walter Reed, the joyride, as well as the coming back to the White House, I don't know how much the poll numbers reflect that yet, but I do think that the more we're talking about COVID, the worse it is for Trump. And I do think that his one sort of great way of rallying people is to hold rallies. He shouldn't be holding any more of those.
Considering the fact that President Trump may have initiated a super spreader disease at the reception for Amy Coney Barrett and his introduction of her to a large group of people at the White House, what do you think is the way forward for that nomination? Do you see it moving forward as planned by Republicans?
Well, you saw, I'm sure, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who has also come down with coronavirus, saying he would wear a space suit if necessary to vote for her confirmation. I think that the calculation by Mitch McConnell and the president still is that come hell or high water, we're going to get this confirmation done before November the 3rd. There are some measures available to Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, to delay and slow down. But from what I understand, not by long enough to prevent the vote happening before the week prior to the election. And so if there are more Republican senators, one or two more, come down with the disease, there's going to be a problem. And Mitch McConnell might be able to change the rules all of a sudden, do a U-turn on that and say we can have proxy or remote voting. But he'd need to have a quorum to change the rules. So he'd need the 51, or I guess the 50 plus the vice president, to get that through. So my guess is he will get her confirmed if there are no more infections of Republican senators. Right now we have three. We have Tom Tillis of North Carolina. We have Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Mike Lee of Utah. One or two more and the whole strategy is in trouble.
And of course, the vice presidential debate is going to be held on Wednesday night. What do you expect from that, Ed?
That's going to be arguably the most consequential vice presidential debate that we've seen for a long time, if not ever, because, you know, we've got a 74-year-old president and a 77-year-old Democratic nominee, and therefore a great deal more focus, more even than when, you know, Sarah Palin was John McCain's running mate, because of the chances that one or other could become president if they're the top of their ticket wins. I think that Mike Pence has got a very beguiling way of reducing the temperature. If you watch him, you don't feel sort of too animated by what he's saying. If you read the transcript, you're jumping up and down with. But the way he says it is a sort of quite becoming, sort of Indiana style, Midwest nice. And so I don't think the temperature is going to be that high. That said, Kamala Harris can be quite a pugilist. She can go for the jugular. And we've seen her do that, you know, in some of the Senate judiciary hearings. And I guess we're going to see that again, by the way, for the Amy Coney Barrett hearing, because she's still on that committee. So I think she's going to try and shake him up. And he's going to try and be the Teflon man.
Finally, Ed, you recently wrote how the chaos in the U.S. is being seen by the rest of the world. How do you see that?
Funny enough, I was on a Zoom call today with a very, very senior German politician who was talking in wonderment but sorrow about this spectacle of America's president treating this disease as if it were like the common cold, and the sadness, I guess, but also concern. So, you know, he did discuss what might happen if Trump were reelected, and that sounded fairly apocalyptic.
Spell that out.
He thought that Trump in term two would be times four Trump in the first term. Times four. NATO would be over. Essentially, the West would be over. And that America's allies would assume America is gone for good, rather than there was a sort of freak of nature aberration. Because this would sort of confirm. But, you know, he then went on to say he thought Biden would win, and he thought that if Biden did win, that this would be a great sort of opportunity to try again and to get things back onto a more positive track. So from, you know, the convention says they can't speak in public about which president they prefer, but unless you're from Hungary or Poland, or from the sort of one of the far right parties, pretty much across Europe, even in Boris Johnson's Conservative Party, I think there's a not-too-secret hope to see Biden win rather than Trump re-elected.
Ed Luce, thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Always a delight, Diane. Thank you.
That was Edward Luce, U.S. National Editor and columnist at the Financial Times. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruttenberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you'll continue to wear those masks, keep safe distances, take care of yourself and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.